While the rest of the country viewed Florida's midterm elections and a campaign to protect Florida's bonneted bat. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Florida bonneted bat is endangered and running out of places to live. But what if someone said that you can help by joining a larger movement to embrace the bat in order to protect it? We're going to talk with folks from Zoo Miami about a project to build special homes for these bats and what we can do to help. Also, election officials say that thousands of mail-in ballots in Florida were not counted in this past midterm. Florida is once again in the national spotlight for elections troubles. We're going to talk about how the country views Florida during these elections and probably in 2020, as well as free speech and other issues with 1A's Joshua Johnson. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Florida is home to one of the rarest and most endangered bats in the world. The Florida bonneted bat is the largest in the state. They can reach up to 6.5 inches in length. Now, the bats are only found in South Florida, and they've adapted extremely well to the region's urban landscape. They've been found hiding in abandoned office buildings and in Spanish tile roofs. Don't freak out. Hold on. But their existence is continually being threatened by sea level rise and continuous development. Just a few weeks ago, three environmental groups, including the Center for Biological Diversity, sued the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They argued that bats are not being adequately protected. Bat Conservation International, Zoo Miami, and NextEra Energy recently partnered together to build more bat houses, conduct research on the species, and begin a civilian science project. Frank Ridgely, the Zoo Miami conservationist and veterinarian, joins us now in studio. Frank, such a pleasure. Thanks so much, man.
Thanks, Liz. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Malia Bayless with Bat Conservation International. She joins us from Colorado. Malia, such a pleasure. Thank you for joining the program.
Hi. Thanks, Louis. And hi, Frank. Happy to be here.
You know what? Let's start with this. This is a fascinating topic. Frank, tell us, though, real quickly, just to remind people, describe the bonneted bat. You know, let them know what it is so people know, because it's very unique. It's very rare. It's only here in South Florida.
Correct. It's only, it's very South Florida. It's isolated just to the southern tip of Florida. It's scattered around 8 counties, and it's our largest bat. And it's, I'm a little biased. I think it's a good-looking bat, too, which always helps with the PR.
Okay, now, first of all, you know, people will look at bats and they'll tell you something.
I know.
But describe it, because it's got a unique look to it.
It does. It has very large ears that come over the front of its face when it's in flight, and it makes it look like it has a bonnet on its head. So that's where it gets its name, the Florida bonneted bat.
And it's an endangered species.
Yes, very endangered. One of the rarest mammals in the world, I think.
Well, how many are left? Do we know?
That's a good question. No, it was only really formally described in 2004. And then in up to about 2014, there was only one known roost of the species. Now, we've discovered more in the past few years with a lot of research efforts, but not much is known about it.
So where do you typically find them? Because I had mentioned a couple of places where it's been reported they've been seen. But, yeah, where do they like to hang out? Where's the best place for them to live?
Well, in other places in Florida, you find them in kind of in still some intact natural habitats, mostly pine forests, it seems like. And so that's what everyone kind of knows, but Miami's special, right? We're special. We have unique things to the environment here. And in Miami, unfortunately, since it has been transformed, what was once a pine forest that stretched from North Miami Beach all the way down to Florida City, now it's an urban landscape. And just one person's lifetime, it has transformed into that. So these bats, though, are adaptable enough, which many endangered species are not when their habitat is kind of wiped out. But they're living in artificial structures, mainly people's homes.
Okay, so that's why I told people, don't freak out just yet until you know a little bit more about them. Malia, you know, one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, and we'll talk a bit more about the endangered aspect and what kind of protection that provides them. But there's this part of this project is also not just to build homes for them so they have that space, but really to kind of convince South Floridians to almost adopt the bonneted bat as their own. Why is that?
Yeah, this is what I think is one of the funnest parts of this project, is that South Floridians have an opportunity to really own their relationship with this bat. And there are ways that we can listen for the bats acoustically using special devices. And part of this project is to try and develop a core group of people who would be interested in walking surveys through their communities, listening for bats with a bat detector that attaches to your iPhone or your Android. And they have a signature call that you can detect, and those calls can be turned into us and we can verify them and perhaps find new roosts. And so this is a great way we think that people who live in these communities can help us find new roosts and help us identify ways that we can conserve the species in their own backyard.
Now, I know that some people may get a little queasy when you think about bats, but something interesting, and I didn't know this, but, you know, my producer, Alejandra, lived in Austin. And in Austin, the folks there, residents there, they have a Mexican tail bat that lives there. And they've just adopted this as, like, you know, just a beloved creature within the city, right? Isn't that, Malia? Is that pretty much, you know, they treat it like it's something to revere, and it's actually a tourist attraction.
Yeah, you bet. In fact, Bat Conservation International has our headquarters in Austin, Texas, for that very reason. And you can't throw a stone in Texas, in Austin, without hitting a statue of a bat or some kind of conversation piece about the bats in Austin, because Austin has really adopted that bat colony as part of their identity. And they're very protective of the bat colony under the bridge. And thousands of people come to Austin and sit under that bridge and watch the bats fly out and eat ice cream cones and enjoy the natural spectacle of that wildlife emergence every night during the summer. And it's really become part of the fabric of that community.
And so do you think that I don't think that we have enough bonneted bats to have anything like that. But do you think that something like that could eventually happen here, Frank? And is that kind of what we need? Because it would, if we care about it, we're going to want to protect it.
Yeah. Well, the Mexican free-tailed bat, they form huge colonies, millions of bats. The Florida bonded bat likes much smaller colonies, so we're not going to get a spectacle like that. But, you know, people need to appreciate, too, that these bats are out here in Miami working every night for us. We don't think about it. We don't even realize it. But they're eating all these flying insects. And there's actually been studies that show that bats contribute billions each year to offsetting pesticide use for agriculture. They've mainly studied agriculture. Who knows, in an urban landscape, you know, a lot of Floridians don't like flying insects running around too. These bats are out there cleaning our skies every night. So they do provide a benefit to every resident here, and that's something to look at them a little differently.
Real quickly, you know, we said that they're endangered, but there are obviously groups that believe that there isn't enough protection for them. But what kind of protection do they have, and what's needed?
Well, right now, the service is mostly concentrating on protecting their roosts, because that's where they are during the day. That's where they raise their young. That's their safe shelter. So it gets a little difficult in Miami, right? You can't declare a mansion in Coral Gables a protected roost.
Right.
We try to have people who maybe are not so shy about having bats to maybe welcome them as your neighbor. But part of our project that we've been doing with NextEra and our other sponsors is putting up safe harbor for these bats. So maybe they'll move in, or maybe at least their offspring will.
All right. You know what? We're going to continue this conversation about the bonneted bat. I'm talking with Frank Ridgely, Miami Zoo conservationist and director of veterinarian services. Also, we're talking with Malia Bayless with Bat Conservation International. Again, Zoo Miami recently teamed up with BCI to conduct research and build bat homes for these bats. And we're going to learn more about those homes coming up. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. All right, so we were talking about the bonneted bat. It's an endangered species here in South Florida, and it's unique to South Florida because you only find it here. You may have seen it, perhaps. Again, it's about the size of a mango in your hand, and it's got these big ears that are cute, but I guess it's all subjective, right, whether you think a bat is cute or not. We're talking with Frank Ridgely. He's with Miami Zoo, a Zoo Miami conservationist and director of the veterinarian services. Also, Malia Bayless with Bat Conservation International. And again, Zoo Miami recently teaming up with BCI to conduct research and build bat homes for the species. So, Frank, coming back to this, I wanted to ask, what are the biggest threats right now? What are the greatest risks to the bat that's damaging perhaps their opportunity to grow?
Well, there's long-term risk like sea level rise and more habitat loss and things like that. But the the day-to-day risks here in Miami that I want everyone to kind of realize and think about is, yes, some people may not want to have a bat as a neighbor or a roommate, but it's also dangerous for the bat. Because if they're living in roofs, anyone who goes and tries to get their roof replaced here in Miami, they could accidentally harm or kill a federally endangered species that's living there. The other thing is also termite tenting, right? You could have a colony of these bats in your home. You would never know it. They don't make any noise. They don't smell. And you get your house termite tented, and you could kill off a whole colony of this very rare species.
So if in case you happen to have them in your home and you don't want them there, I mean, what do you tell people? What is how would you, I guess, kind of help them find another place?
Well, we developed with the University of Florida, too, like a handout, a guide for South Floridians, too, that you can find on our website and BCI's website, and signs look to see if you might have bats in your house or around. And then you have to contact, if you do find that you have bats, you contact a licensed pest control company that should be aware of the species in the area, and then you work to try to identify what species it is.
And I think that's interesting, as you pointed out, it's an endangered species. So there's a whole other level of there. It's not, you just can't get rid of them. Malia, let's talk about these homes you guys are trying to build for the bats, because you're trying to build a specific, I guess, really a safe place for them.
Yeah, and these homes, they're called bat houses, but they're basically a giant box with crevices on the interior. And the bats will tuck up into these crevices like they would tuck under a Spanish tile. And they find a very safe and warm and stable place to roost there. And these bat houses need to be placed pretty high up on steel poles to keep them away from predators and have lots of solar exposure to make sure those homes are kept very warm so the bats can thermoregulate and raise their young, inside these alternative roosts.
And how many of these are you guys planning to build? How many do you want to build, and where do you want to put them?
Well, Frank, can you help me out with that? Because you've led this work primarily. So, I'd like to defer to you on that.
So right now we've installed 16 installations with two houses on them each, all across Miami-Dade County in kind of protected areas. And we placed them strategically where we'd already confirmed the bats were feeding at night. So we say they're foraging areas, so big, wide open areas. So we put them there in hopes that the bats will discover them while they're going at night. And like I said, hopefully some of them will start to move in.
And that's what the other thing too is you're hoping they move in, or is there a way that you can entice them to want to, you know,
there isn't anything really to lure them. It's just putting all the best practices and placing it in the most ideal setting you think you can. But we've already had success because we've installed some of these around the zoo where we know the bats come every night. And we already had some of the homes moved into. So that was within 3 weeks we had to move in, which is unheard of.
And Malia, once you get those bats in there, then, the other part of the research, my understanding is, I mean, this gives you then the opportunity to really do more studies on them, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Then we have known colonies that we can look at questions like what kinds of insects are they eating? Where are they foraging? How can we protect habitat and food sources for these bats? And in order to ask those questions, we need to have stable colonies of bats that hopefully aren't in people's homes that we can ask those questions with.
And the other thing, too, is this, and either of you can answer this, is that, you know, with an endangered species, you're trying to get the population back up. You want to get it off the list. So, but do we have any examples of other species similar to this that you could say, that's how to successfully do it?
You bet. In fact, just recently, last spring, we delisted Leptonycteris yerbabuena, which is a nectar-feeding bat in the American Southwest. And those populations were stabilized by protecting roosts and protecting their foraging areas and the foods that they eat. And so I think the same can be done with this species, although the distribution is so limited. They're in so few counties in such a limited area, and their populations are quite, quite low. I think it might be a little bigger challenge than with the nectar bats in the Southwest. But it is possible, and the Endangered Species Act is set up to delist species once they're stable.
There are bonneted bats over at Zoo Miami, right?
Yeah.
Frank?
They visit and forage there every night, as well as quite a few other spots across the county.
Is it an opportunity for people to see them?
They're hard to see at the zoo because they're kind of in some back areas, but the Granada Golf Course in Coral Gables, that is the long, as far as a foraging area, that has the longest history of a known foraging area. You can actually go to Granada Golf Course in the Gables and watch bats fly around. And this bat is unique because its call is actually down in the human hearing range while the others are above. So if you're young, oftentimes you can go out there and you can actually hear them calling above you and foraging at night. And they're unmistakable. They're very long wings.
And just also a reminder, because Malia, I think you also said there's an app where you could use to actually hear the bat?
Yeah, there are devices called bat detectors out there on the market. And you can buy them, and they basically take the ultrasonic calls of bats and they convert it down into through an app on your phone, so you can see the call and you can hear it within the range of your human hearing, so it converts that sound. And now these things are, the technology has advanced so much that now these things are getting affordable. They're the price of a pair of binoculars, you know, $200-$300. And so you can go bat watching kind of with your ears, like bird watching, but you gotta, you know, put on your jacket and go at night.
Well, now I'm convinced there's an app for everything. Again, we've been talking with Frank Ridgely, Miami Zoo conservationist and director of veterinarian services, and Malia Bayless with Bat Conservation International. Again, Zoo Miami recently teaming up with BCI to conduct research and build bat homes for the endangered bat, the bonneted bat, only found here in South Florida. Frank, Malia, it's been such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. And you can also go to our Facebook page, WLRN Sundial. Check out some cool pics of the bonneted bat. It is kind of cute. It's not so bad. All right. Still to come, we're going to talk about the role Florida played in the last midterm, what role it's going to play in 2020. Also, the role of public radio programs like this one with Joshua Johnson from 1A. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, even though the 2018 midterms is in our rearview mirror, really it's not. Not yet. Today we learned that more than 6,700 mail-in ballots were not counted. Why? Well, because according to the state, they were turned in late. Two counties have yet to report on how many actual mail-in ballots haven't been counted. They include Polk County and Palm Beach County. Add to that, there are a lot of people in Broward County who are angry that Governor Scott replaced Brenda Snipes as supervisor of elections with his former attorney. So how did the rest of the country view all of this? Because, well, it's in our backyard, so, you know, we see it every day. Well, joining us now is Joshua Johnson, host of 1A. 1A airs Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on WLRN, and he's joining us from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. By the way, you'll remember, too, that we got to work with him during the midterm elections coverage. Joshua, such a pleasure. Always, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Lewis. How's it going?
It's going really well. I mean, this story just doesn't go away, but look, you know how things are here in South Florida when it comes to elections. In Palm Beach County has been in the news before. With all the stuff about recounts, the mail-in ballots, waiting to get the count done, everything, how did the rest of the country view it? How did you see it from where you're at?
Ah, Florida. Florida, 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 in the words of the late, great Tim Russert, it's always Florida. Or as some people around here have been saying, freaking Florida, every single time. Look, I am from Palm Beach County. I'm a West Palm Beach native. So I was there for the 2000 election and hanging Chad and butterfly ballots. I interviewed Brenda Snipes back when I was a reporter at WLRN. You know, she had been there for quite a long time. This just seems to be one of those perennial fling your hands up in disgust moments where people are like, ugh. Why can't they vote in Florida? I mean, there are people that I have encountered when they ask, where are you from? And I'll say Florida. They'll be like, oh, I'm sorry. Oh. Like, yeah, I know. On behalf of the 18 million residents of the state of Florida, I apologize that none of us knows how to vote. I mean, this is one of those things that became a national laughingstock. But this year in particular, I think, was part of a larger conversation about voting access and the fairness of the voting system. You got to remember, it's not just what was happening in Florida. It was larger issues of access to absentee voting, early voting, gerrymandering. This is kind of a wave of attention that the nation was part of. So I don't think it was quite like the year 2000, where Florida singularly galvanized voting rights activists to teach people like how to get registered and advocating for early voting. And if you're in line when the polls close, stay in line. You are entitled to vote. That's what happened last time around. That's what happened when I was still a reporter at WLRN. this is now Florida as part of a larger conversation. Because don't forget, we also talked about some of these same matters in Wisconsin, particularly in Georgia, with the race between its Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, and his Democratic challenger, Stacey Abrams. Florida is now, thankfully, an object lesson in some of the issues with voting, but it's no longer the object lesson.
And no, exactly. And North Carolina is still actually having some of its own issues right now. So then we push forward to 2020, and you know that's going to be a big one. That's the presidential election. And so, you know, the question then is, at least for us here, is are we going to get it together before that? But it seems like it's not just issues in Florida anymore. So maybe it's not, you know, maybe we're not going to be the center of attention come 2020. Or, I don't know, you think it's Florida, so maybe we will.
Oh, don't be silly, Lewis. You know Florida has to be the center of attention all the time. We are definitely going to be the center of attention in 2020 for a few reasons. First of all, let's not forget, the midterm elections were basically decided for the Senate race and the governor's race by 50-50 votes. That's a big deal. Like, Rick Scott won his Senate seat with 50% of the vote plus a hair. Ron DeSantis won the governor's race with like 50% plus a hair. These were not blowouts. This is a different time than some of the previous statewide elections, the big consequential ones, where Florida Democrats were just kind of like, well, we'll do our best. We'll get South Florida. We'll get the environs around Orlando, parts of Tampa. And that happened this time around, but these were squeakers. These were not blowouts. Also, there was Amendment 4 in Florida that restored felons' voting rights.
Right.
That passed by a 2-1 margin. Floridians wanted that. And we know that many of the felons whose rights would be restored are largely people of color. And people of color in Florida tend to vote Democratic. So this is not going to be a fait accompli for Florida in 2020. I think 2020 could be just as unpredictable in Florida and just as consequential as it has ever been.
And we all just hold our breath. But, you know, talking about the...
Oh, no, I'm not holding my breath no more. If I held my breath, I wouldn't be alive talking to you today, which I think is one of the joys of kind of covering Florida, right? That's why I loved being at WLRN, because you can't predict what's going to happen. You just have to watch. You just have to pay attention.
Yeah, well, you get to watch from the outside. We're in it, so... talking about the 2020 election, I thought this was fascinating because 1A is working on a special project. You guys just got a grant from the Corporation of Public Broadcasting, and you're going to be putting together this project called 1A Across America, and it's before the 2020 election, and it's about trying to find stories that we're not hearing enough of. But let me ask you this about what that project is, and how did you guys get the grant? Was that something you applied for, or how did you find out about it?
We did. We worked with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to secure the grant. It's worth $750,000, and it's a 2-year collaboration to incorporate more voices into our election coverage in the run-up to the 2020 election. You'll hear a lot of reports from the quote-unquote heartland of America right around election time. Everyone's turned on cable news, and you see the shot from Main Street, a bunch of people at a diner having their breakfast wondering why there's a camera in their face. And that's kind of the mainstream of this coverage. Well, what we wanted to do was to bring new voices into that coverage, and not just in the swing states or in the contested districts, but in places that tend to get ignored all the time unless they are in play. There's something wrong with that. And one of our responsibilities as public broadcasters is to present a conversation with the nation that sounds like the entire nation and not just the ones that are really hot or really juicy or really contentious. So we're working with 6 stations, WBHM in Birmingham, Michigan Radio, which is based in Ann Arbor, KUNC, which is in northern Colorado, Houston Public Media, Minnesota Public Radio, and KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. We're going to visit all 6 of those stations at least once next year and in 2020. So not only will we be bringing some different kinds of voices, but it won't just be a parachute in and out. You'll hear from them at least twice.
And what do you think we're going to hear? I mean, the thing I always hear that too, we always hear that, you know, that so much of the media is focused on the coasts. You know, and life in the big cities, but that we forget the middle. But we're all Americans. What are you going to hear? What do you think we're going to hear that's any different? They have the same concerns, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, the nice thing is I don't know what we're going to hear. We got to go show up. And we've got two great producers, James Morrison and Amanda Williams, who are our 1A Across America producers who are traveling to these markets. Like James and Amanda were just in Minnesota recently. They were just in Houston. They're bringing some tape that will be airing this week on our program. And the nice thing is we can go and connect with people and show up without too many expectations other than trying to spark conversations with them about what's going on where you live. And how can we tell that story more clearly? I think there's lots of parts of the country that really don't get the full story told, even if they are battlegrounds. I mean, even on the coasts, you look at a state like California. California doesn't really get a lot of deep election coverage because everyone knows it's going to go solid blue. But that doesn't mean that there aren't issues that Californians deal with, all 38 million of them, that bear discussion. California is an ATM for the Democrats and the Republicans. It almost never gets deep coverage. They barely get campaign visits. When I was at KQED, the Democrats would raise huge amounts of money in California. Hillary Clinton never did one public campaign event. Not one. Raised millions, never talked to the people. We're going to be in Los Angeles next month, in fact, in January, because it's cold in Washington. But we'll be at KPCC Los Angeles to talk about that very thing, the fact that Californians fund American politics, but they never drive the conversation, even though they are the most populous nation. So there's lots of room for us to improve the way we talk to Americans before, during, and after the big elections.
And real quickly, is, you know, I was thinking about that list of stations that you had. How did you pick them?
The team here at 1A picked them. We tried to pick stations that represent a variety of different geographies, sizes of markets, different kinds of communities, communities with different kinds of sub-communities and enclaves to try to tell a very broad and a varied picture.
Again, talking with Joshua Johnson, host of 1A. It airs here Monday through Friday starting at 10 o'clock. And we're talking about the midterm elections. We're talking about the new project they're working on, 1A Across America, which is going to lead up into the 2020 election. And yeah, we're talking about the election in 2020 already. That's true. Joshua, don't go anywhere. We're going to take a quick break. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. And by the way, thank you so much for pledging your support to our station. I want to return to our conversation that we were having with host of 1A, Joshua Johnson. Again, he's joining us from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. And we're talking about the midterm election. We're talking about, you know, really the role that Florida is going to play, has played in numerous elections and how it will play in many more to come, of course. We also talked about his new program that they're going to be doing, 1A Across America, a project, I should say, on their program, where they're going to be finding stories across the country leading up to that election in 2020. Joshua, something I wanted to chat about with you is the other day you did a program about the First Amendment. And I mean, you could spend hours talking about this, but
yeah,
something I found really fascinating, I was thinking about myself as I was listening, is, okay, hate speech has been around. I mean, it's not new. It just seems like it's been blasted by the internet. It seems like it's just everywhere now, or it's louder, or it's just maybe we're hearing it more often. But I wondered if you ever come across a question of, is there ever a time when you won't talk to somebody on air because of their speech, or do we have a responsibility to hear everybody?
Yeah, we have had those conversations. By the way, thank you for having that pledge break. I realized that my Circle of Friends membership had lapsed, and so I updated it online.
Oh, I'm going to tell Bonnie that.
It's true. I have been a member for some time, because without WLRN, we would not be having this conversation today. So I'm very grateful to those of you who've shown your support. Thank you. In terms of guests that we would not have on, we had that conversation about Steve Bannon, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
We talked about a month and a half ago, I think it was 2 months. Time kind of loses all meaning when you're covering news in Washington. But It was the controversy regarding him speaking at that New Yorker festival. You remember that? And
yes.
There was a big outcry as to whether he was welcome, and they dropped from that festival, and the Economist picked him up for another. And we debated, you know, would we book Steve Bannon? And, you know, there were differences of opinion among the producers of 1A, all of whom made some really valid points. The challenges that we ran into were, first of all, that Steve Bannon's whole currency is his ability to work the media. Like, we are his stock in trade, and he is so practiced at this. He is such an eager pugilist with the press that there's kind of no way to just have an affable conversation with him. It would be incredibly difficult. And I'm a nice guy, but he's going to come in here with an agenda. It's that whole thing about, you know, wrestling with a pig, you get dirty and the pig enjoys it. So do we want to deal with someone whose whole job, whose whole goal in dealing with the mainstream media is to dirty it, is to drag it down to the kind of conversation he wants to have? On the other hand, if we were offered an interview with Bashar al-Assad, who's the president of Syria, would we take it? The answer is probably yes. But Bashar al-Assad has killed children. He's gassed his own people. He's committed acts of genocide. But we would interview him. Why not Steve Bannon? He's never killed anyone. He's never killed anyone's children. Why is he off limits? The other aspect of this is the way that we would interview him. The interview doesn't necessarily have to be live. One of our producers, one of our brilliant senior producers, had the idea that perhaps we interview him to tape. And then the live part of the show would be some guests in studio who would react to what he says to us. Because with a guest like Steve Bannon, he's going to move so fast. You got to be able to fact check him in real time, and we just couldn't.
Yeah.
So maybe we interview him, and then maybe we play like a 7-minute chunk at the top of the show, unedited, like a complete clean 7 minutes, talk about it with our guests in studio, and then, because we know he's going to say, they took me out of context, we release the entire hour raw on the 1A.org.
Yeah.
So we would be covering all kinds of different bases. There's no one right answer to this. Like, I am inclined to talk to the people who get under our skin because they get under our skin, because that bears investigation. But I do accept that there are risks in having these conversations. Part of the challenge of journalism is figuring out how to have these conversations. Or as it was once put to me, journalism is not about reporting. It's about editing.
Yeah. Let me ask you about journalism on this note, and I only have a couple of minutes here, but, you know, journalists have been attacked for a long time, but, you know, these last couple of years, again, it's felt a little bit harsher. And Time magazine, by the way, just named slain journalists as their person of the year. That was announced, I think, within the last couple of hours. But, you know, I don't want to paint us as perfect either. And I'm curious your take on this. You know, where have we failed? You know, how have we come up short as the news media? What could we be doing better?
Everything. We could be doing everything better. We fail daily. We're human beings. But remember that the point of this experiment, this democracy, is not to be perfect. Our founders called us to be more perfect. We're not here to be your iron wall against everything you dislike. The First Amendment is not designed for speech that you like. It's designed to protect speech that the government does not like. And that includes criticism. That's where the press comes in. That's where journalism comes in. And it is an imperfect art. It's not a science. We need to renegotiate the contract between the people and the press and almost reintroduce ourselves to the public, because some of the expectations that people have are legitimate if you understand the way the press is actually supposed to comport itself in this democracy. We make huge mistakes because there are huge challenges. That doesn't mean that the press has failed. It means that the press is growing. It's changing. It's evolving. We're trying to do this work better and better. We're trying to help make this union more perfect by being the eyes and ears of the public, because we're citizens too. So are we failing? Yeah. I probably failed at something today. I'm going to fail at something tomorrow. But remember that old saying, ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail better. The problem is not that the press will fail. The problem would be if we cease to fail better.
Always a pleasure, Joshua. I really appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Lewis. Thank you.
Joshua Johnson, again, host of 1A, joining us from WAMU in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for listening to Sundial. We'll be back tomorrow.